Welcome to the South Harbor Church Podcast. South Harbor is a part of the Harbor Churches, which exists to help people find their way back to God. This week, once again, as we continue in our series called Exiles, we take a look at how to avoid cynicism. As always, for more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, stick around after the message. And now, once again, here's Pastor Tim.
I haven't met you yet. My name is Tim, and it's really good to see you all again. I'm glad you're with us. I'd love to have, if you have a moment after the service or at some point, I'd love to, if we haven't met, I'd love to chat, get to know you a little bit. I can do this now. This is the first year Liza said, if you want to grow it this year, go for it. You're wearing a mask anyway. Hey, we're going to be in Daniel chapter 5. We are week 5 in a sermon series where we've been working through the book of Daniel. And if you've been with us for the series, if you've been engaging online or listening to the podcast, I'm hoping that you're finding this book as interesting, as fascinating as I have, as I've been studying the book. And as every week it feels like I get to I know it's opening day of hunting too, right? So for me, it feels like I get to hunt through the story and find all these really interesting things. And Sundays, I get to drag my thing back and show you all. I don't know if that metaphor works. But for me, Daniel has been really, really interesting. Just a quick recap, a 30-second recap for those of you who missed any of the weeks of the series. Daniel is a story of, when we first meet him, he's a teenager, somewhere between the ages of 13 and 17, a teenage boy named Daniel who is kidnapped, captured, and carried away to a foreign empire, him alongside of three of his best friends. And they're brought into this foreign empire, an empire known as Babylon, in an event known as the Babylonian Exile. When it comes to the stories of the Old Testament that shaped the Old Testament, It's probably the Exodus and then the exile. This story is formative for the Jewish people, absolutely formative for the Jewish people. About a full third of our Old Testament is devoted to this moment in history. Psalms, prophets, historical books, all dedicated to the exile. But Daniel records a firsthand account of it. So Daniel's actually in the exile. And as a recap, we've been traveling with Daniel. But between Daniel 1 and Daniel 4, about 35 years of time go by. So Daniel moves from a teenager into about 50 years old in the course of a couple of chapters. Now, so the story is about Daniel and his friends, but it's also, we meet another guy, the king of Babylon. And anybody remember the king of Babylon's name? It rhymes with Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah, Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, good guy or bad guy? When we first meet him, totally a bad guy. He wages war against a relatively innocent nation. Israel's, they've done some things that are, I mean, on the global stage, they're pretty innocent. Internally, they're not so much. They're bowing down to idols, we're told. The two reasons we're given for why the exile happens, God says, is because you're bowing down to idols, and I told you to let the land rest every 7 years, and you're not. You're just like consume, 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 produce, produce, produce. So no, we're going to let the land rest after all the years you didn't let it rest in exile, which is interesting. But they're relatively innocent, right? They're relatively innocent. They're not waging war on the Babylonians. They're not provoking the Babylonians. They're trying to stay out of the way. And yet the Babylonians storm in at the orders of Nebuchadnezzar. And in addition, they tear down the temple. They destroy all the holy places. They take the young men captive, those who would serve in the military or those who were in line for nobility. Daniel's set in line to be a king someday, and he's taken away to cut off the nobility line. In addition to this, there are some kids, so never mind. The story that happens with the king, when he captures the king of Israel, that story is gruesome, and so I'll let you read the story on its own. 2 Kings 25, gruesome story, but Nebuchadnezzar is an evil man when we first meet him. He has a dream and he wants people, can you interpret the dream? And when they can't interpret the dream, he wants to kill them on the spot, just evil dude. And Daniel has to step in and say, well, I can interpret the dream, don't kill them, don't kill them, don't kill them. Then a couple years go by and Nebuchadnezzar creates a 90-foot statue. Most think it's either a statue of Marduk, the main god, or more likely It's a statue of Nebuchadnezzar himself, and he says, bow down to the statue. And when people refuse to bow down to the statue, three guys refuse to bow down to the statue, he throws them in a fiery furnace. Thankfully, God saves them and spares their life. But this is Nebuchadnezzar. He, when we first meet him, he's the bad guy. Daniel, good guy, serious spiritual muscle. Nebuchadnezzar, not such a good guy. Then we get to chapter 4, which we looked at last week. And in chapter 4, it's like a complete 180 for Nebuchadnezzar. He has another vision, and Daniel interprets the vision again. He ignores the vision for a while, but eventually he finds out that what Daniel was saying is true. And over the course of 35 years, Daniel's faith turns his enemy into his friend. And beyond that, his enemy's God into his God. Chapter 4 of Daniel is Nebuchadnezzar writing in his own pen a letter, an edict sent out to the leaders of the whole world saying, the God of Daniel is no joke. The God of Daniel is the living God, he says. So there's like this bad guy, horrible, evil man, and Daniel continues to love him. He continues to wish the best for him. He continues to pray for him and with him. And finally, over the course of 35 years, you get to chapter 4, 180 degrees spin around, and you've got Nebuchadnezzar, the bad guy, praising God, releasing the captives. I mean, it's just this beautiful, beautiful story. And you kind of get to the end of chapter 4, and it's like, roll the credits. This is how the movie's supposed to end, right? This is the ending we've been waiting for. You get to the end of it, and you're like, this is how it's supposed to end. This is like the Christmas Hallmark ending of the movie. Anybody else? Last week was the week it was really nice out, right? Last weekend? Yeah. I'm lost in time. Last weekend, Liza, my wife, and I decided to hang up our Christmas tree lights. Now, normally, we're purists, and we wait until after Thanksgiving, because that's what you do, but it's 2020, and there are no rules. And so we said, you know what? We need a little Christmas. We're going to hang up the lights and start listening to some Christmas music. Anybody else already hang up your lights? Yes. Yeah, my people. So we hung up the lights, and the kids, we sang some songs with the kids, and like we're already in Christmas mode. It kind of feels really nice. We started watching the movies, more my wife than me. She's my lovely, effervescent wife. She's already watching Holiday and Operation Christmas Drop and all those movies. By the way, she says Holiday pretty good. Operation Christmas Drop, not so good. I asked her last night. And I saw an article this week that there are 40 new Hallmark Christmas movies coming out this year. Yes, 40. My conspiracy theory is that Hallmark is behind all of this. They're just cashing it in. 40. But can we agree on when it comes to like Hallmark Christmas movies, while there may be 40 movies, there's really only 3 plot lines. Have you learned this? There's really only 3. Plot line number 1. If I had to distill all of them down, plot line number 1, I would call the reunion. He has a corporate job in New York City, and he's home for the reunion because he's got this family party to go to for Christmas, but he hasn't been home in a while, but he comes home a little bit early, and then he sees her. And he hasn't seen her since high school. Sparks fly. That's number 1. So plot line number 2, the single parent finds love on Christmas. This is the Sleepless in Seattle, right? This one's kind of self-explanatory. Then plot line number 3, I think this is the majority of them, is opposites attract. Opposites attract. This is like the majority of, I don't know how this has to do with Christmas, but I like the premise. Opposites attract. Something along the lines of, she runs the bed and breakfast. It's been in town. It's cute. It's quaint. He's coming in with the hotel that's like got all the perks and the indoor pool and all this stuff. But she runs the bed and breakfast, and she knows that if he comes in, she may be out of a job, and this has been in town forever. But he's got abs. And so sparks fly, the movie ends, and they're sitting in the bed and breakfast, like having their Christmas dinner in the bed and breakfast, right? Is this not all the, yeah, okay. That was fun for me. Now, in the story of Daniel, it kind of feels like it's like a Hallmark Christmas movie. You get to chapter 4, and it's a bit of the opposites attract. Now, it's not, They're not romantically, obviously. It's not a romantic thing, but they are opposites, right? You have the humble servant and the evil king, the young, passionate follower of God and the evil king. You have this guy who continues to choose hope, and you have this evil king who continues to choose pessimism. He refuses to like see Daniel for who Daniel is. And this whole story has been moving to this ending, and chapter 4 feels like the ending we've been waiting for. He gives his life to God, he praises God, and he writes a letter to the whole world saying, God is on the throne, God is alive. Roll the credits, end scene. Cue Ryan Reynolds or Tom Hanks or whatever. This is the end of the movie. Except we're in chapter 4. The movie's not over. Show's not over. The story's not over. If you have a Bible, this is how chapter 5 begins, with these words. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and the silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the kings and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Hang on. What is happening? You get to chapter 5, and if you just don't see it coming. Who's Belshazzar, and what's he doing? Where's Nebuchadnezzar? Like, all of a sudden, we have a new king. Where's Nebuchadnezzar? Short answer, he's dead. It actually, plot twist, he's been dead for 23 years. 23 years. Between chapters 4 and chapters 5 are 23 years. Who's King Belshazzar? I'm glad you asked. Who's King Belshazzar? So in the year 562 B.C., yesterday I was in the car with Liza. Where were we going? We were driving somewhere, and I said something B.C., and my son, who's 6, goes, before Christ? Where do you learn things? I don't remember teaching him the B.C. Anybody else, your kids learn things? You're like, where do you learn the things? I don't know where they learn the things. 562 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar dies. End of chapter 4, right after the events of chapter 4, that happens. Chapter 5 starts in 539 B.C. Now, we know this because the end of this chapter, a nation known as Persia is going to join forces with the Medes, and they're going to take them down. Take like this very night. How dare you get drunk off the goblets from the temple? How dare you? So that's happening this night. So it's 539 B.C., raising the question, what happens during the 23 years between chapter 4 and chapter 5? If we're going to get into the story, what happens between the two events? Again, I'm glad you asked. Essentially, Babylon the Great. Remember week 2? Babylon the Great. Babylon the Great falls. Babylon the Great comes like unraveling. Over the course of 23 years, Babylon the Great unravels. Let me give you the detailed version. That's the short answer. Here's the long answer. Nebuchadnezzar builds one of the most powerful empires the world has ever seen, Babylon. He then, by the end of chapter 4, he gives his life to God, celebrates God. Then he dies, 562 B.C. He dies, leaving a power vacuum. And all these people want to swoop in and take the power. First of all is his son by the name of Amel-Marduk. Amel-Marduk is not in the office very long, and he is murdered for, and I quote, an illegal and impure approach to public affairs. He's murdered by a guy named Nergal Sherazar. Which, by the way, like, honey, what should we name the kid? She's like, I don't know, Brad, John, Jim. How about Nergal Sherazar? No, he'll be an evil villain for sure. Yes, he will. Nergal Sherazar. Nergal Sherazar is every bit as evil as you think. That's his. Nergal Sherazar is the brother-in-law of Amel-Marduk, the son of Nebuchadnezzar. Do you follow? He murders him for an illegal and impure approach to public affairs. I spent about 2 hours chasing this rabbit. What was that about? There's all kinds, we don't know. Short answer is we don't know. We don't know what exactly he did. All we know is that there are some really wild and interesting conspiracy theories online. So if you want to chase them, be my guest. Nebuchadnezzar dies. His son takes over. His son is killed by his brother-in-law, whose name again is Nergal-Sharazar. Nergal-Sharazar reigns for about 4 years, and then he is succeeded by his young son, Labishi-Marduk. Again, remember, I think I said this week too, all Babylonian names make great names for cats, okay? Labishi-Marduk. Labishi-Marduk reigns for only 9 months or so before he's murdered by a guy named Nabonidus. Nabonidus reigns for the longest. He reigns for 15 years, but there's an issue with Nabonidus. Nabonidus, once he steps into the throne, realizes that the Arabians want to take over the nation, so he finds himself caught up in a foreign country in a war for 15 years, and the people of Babylon say, well, we deserve a king who's on the ground. So they appoint a second king. The second king just so happens to be the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, a king by the name of Belshazzar. Belshazzar is the guy who's mentioned in verse 1. So there's all these internal, there's coups, assassination attempts. I mean, it's a wild story. But in addition to this, there's all these external conflicts. You've got the Arabians to the west, Egypt, who's attacking from the south, and then Persia, who's joining up forces with the Medes, who are attacking from the east. They're all waiting for the opportunity. Chapter 5 is going to end with the Persians attacking and taking over the Babylonians. Babylon's going to fall. And by the way, the way they take it over, this is recorded both in the Bible and in the historical records. The way they take over is so the Euphrates River goes right through the center of the city of Babylon. They dig a canal and reroute the river so that they can walk into the city, go around the gates, and just march right into the city. They dig a canal and reroute the river, and we've got a king who is so clueless, he's throwing a drunken party when there's an imminent threat. Literally, it's not like you just dig a canal and reroute a river overnight. He's so clueless, he's so abdicated responsibility that this imminent threat, he's just like, well, we're not going to worry about that. Let's get drunk. That's the story. Now, clears mud. Okay, that's the long, short story. If you're a history nerd, that's the long story. Short story without the names or the places or the dates is you've got 23 years of internal and external conflict. 23 years. And if you're Daniel, you've given your life to trying to help. And you finally have this moment of success. And chapter 4, it's like finally, after 35 years of walking beside Nebuchadnezzar, there's a moment. And then Nebuchadnezzar dies. And over the course of 23 years, you're Daniel. You're watching it all unravel. And doesn't that feel a little bit like 2020? A little bit? You've heard the phrase, take two steps forward to take one step back. Anybody else feel like 2020 feels a little bit like take one step forward only to take two steps back? Anybody else find yourself in meeting after meeting after meeting trying to figure out a future that changes as soon as you make a decision on the meeting? And it's like spin your wheels. Anybody else get, parents of little ones, anybody else, every time you get an email from school, it's like, oh, book fair, hallelujah, book fair. Yes, here's $20, go buy some junk. Right, like it's like every time, it's like, am I going to have to contact Trace? One step forward, two steps back. I have a friend who started a business in February of this year, and he said that, you know, like it was him and a partner went in on this thing, and like we spent our life savings and we invested it, knowing that if the business did okay, we should be able to turn a profit in the first 5 years. But he's like, no. Instead, we've watched as our lifetime investment is just it's in the restaurant industry. So he's like, I just watched as the money is just kind of like, and he said, I just was talking to him this week, and he said, if there's another shutdown, which, you know, it looks like it could be, I don't know that we pull out of this thing. And so, one step forward, two steps back. I've got a friend who's a pastor who started in a new church right before COVID, and we were talking not too long ago, and he was explaining his experience. And I feel for this guy because I've been a pastor for 8 years here. So I've been here for 8 years. And over the course of 8 years, especially those of you who are here, I've come to really love you and trust you. And I get the sense that you love me and trust me. I think most of you, maybe. And so we've got some banked love and some banked trust. So when we like are stumbling through decision making, like should we wear masks? How do we do this? I'm gonna mess up, but you're like, okay, but we know you love us and we love you and we trust you, and so we'll work with you through this. Like I feel like I've got some of that residual, and then I talk to a guy like this. He's like, I did not have a chance to earn the love and trust of this church yet. I'm just too new. And he said, I cannot tell you how many mean emails I've gotten. And I go to bed at night and I like weep because I'm watching this church. I feel like I know it's not my fault, but it feels like I'm killing this church because I'm watching it die and I don't know how to help it. One step forward, two steps back. What's the point? You have to imagine if you're Daniel in this moment, like I've given my life to serving this. What's the point? Maybe you feel that way with politics right now. Politics is, maybe you just get to the spot where it's like, I don't even know, whatever anymore, like both sides, political, last 25 years of political history in a blip. You've got Clinton saying, I'm going to undo, and he does undo everything Bush Sr. did, and then Bush Jr. comes in W, and he says, I'm going to undo everything that Clinton did, and then you've got, Obama, who's coming in and saying, I'm going to do everything W did, and then you've got Trump saying, I'm just going to undo everything Obama did, and then you've got Biden, who's now saying, the first thing I'm going to do is undo everything that Trump did, and you step back from it, it's like this giant revolving door, and at some point you're thinking, like, take your political, like, what you want to have, like, out of it. It's just like, you find yourself at some point saying, like, what's the point? Anybody else find yourself there a little bit? 2020? What is the point? I have to imagine, if I put myself in Daniel's shoes in this drunken party as like this, like, what's the point? Imminent threat marching in on a dried riverbed. King's getting drunk with his buddies. What's the point? Then this happens. Verse 5. I want you to notice how Daniel responds. Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. Just in case you're wondering where. Oh, by the lampstand. That's where the hand is. In the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote He watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his legs became weak and his knees were knocking. Okay, pause there. This is just too good to not like slow down on. A human hand comes and writes on the wall in the middle of his drunken party. Actually, no. If you read closely, it's not a human hand. It's the fingers of a human hand. Just the fingers. That's worse. Just the fingers. And it says he just stands and watches it happen. Like, because what are you going to do? Pay no attention. Just the fingers. And then we read this detail is the best. When he sees it, his face turns pale, his legs get weak, and his knees knock. One translation of this reads like this. The cords of his loins loosened and his knees knocked together. There's just no way that's not crass to say this. He poops himself. That's what he's done. Which, by the way, is actually the normal response when fingers write on your wall. Verse 7. The king summoned the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. Then he said to the wise men of Babylon, whoever reads the writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he'll be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Then all the king's men came in, and they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. So King Belshazzar became even more terrified, and his face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. Again, pause here. This sounds exactly, almost exactly the same as chapter 2, the first dream that Daniel interprets when he's young, and chapter 4, the dream Daniel interprets right before Nebuchadnezzar dies. Almost the same sequence, the same order of events, the same response of the king is terrified, the same response of let's summon all the magicians and all the astrologers, their same inability to interpret the dream, the same, oh no, now what? Almost identical. Enter the queen. Verse 10. The queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. Now, pause there. The queen is a reference to the now deceased wife of Nebuchadnezzar. In other words, this is his grandma. Okay, so his grandma comes in, which, by the way, what's worse? You're throwing a drunken party with your friends and fingers right on your wall, or grandma shows up after you've had a drunken party with your friends and you've just, the cords of your loins have loosened. Grandma shows up. May the king live forever, she said. Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, which, by the way, is confusing a bit because we think father, this the word means predecessor. So it's actually his grandpa, biologically, but his predecessor. In the time of your grandpa, your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. Your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. He did this because Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and his ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel, and he will tell you what the writing means. So grandma comes in, the queen comes in, and she says, don't lose hope, I know a guy. Now you got to stop and say, well, time out. How does Belshazzar not know the same guy? She goes on to give his resume, like, oh, by the way, this guy, like, he's interpreted all the dreams, he leads all the wise men. He's in charge for 60 years. He's been leading the Magi. You know, the Magi will come and they'll, like, give gifts to baby Jesus. He's the guy that told them the prophecies, most likely. He's leading the Magi. And by the way, his name is Belteshazzar. So, you know, your name only with a T? Like, that's his name. At some point, you got to wonder, like, why? How does Belshazzar, not the grandson of the king, never, how's he never heard of Daniel? And we don't know. The assumption is either Nebuchadnezzar tells him about Daniel and about the God that he gives his life to at the end. Either he tells him and Belshazzar doesn't listen, or he never tells him. When Liza and I, my wife and I, were first pregnant with our firstborn, I was terrified. I'm like, I've never done the parenting thing before. And so I looked around. I was here at the time. So I looked around, and I looked for men who had sons, because we knew, we didn't know it was a boy. Men who had kids kids were old enough that I could look at and say, wow, those kids are the kind of kids I want my kids to be like someday. And I simply had a list of questions, and I asked them out for coffee and said, hey, can I have like 2 hours of your time? I got a ton of questions. I just want to know how you do it. And then I had all these questions about, how did you talk about faith? How did you discipline? I mean, all those kinds of questions. And one of the dads said to me, and I wrote it down in a journal, and I looked it up this week. He said, Tim, here's the thing. He said, you're a pastor. These are his words. You're a pastor. You're going to spend your life thinking about how to tell people about Jesus. None of it is as important as telling your kids. And the way you tell your kids about Jesus is not just with your words. You have to show them. The same guy told me a story about Billy Graham from his memoirs. Apparently, there's a story in Billy Graham's, you know, Billy Graham, the evangelist, probably led more people to Jesus in his lifetime than anyone in the modern era. But Billy Graham, as the story goes, as he tells the story, he comes home from one of his great tent revivals where he's been gone for a while. And he comes home and he sees a dude in his front lawn. And he thinks, well, who's this guy? And he sees this guy, turns around, and he looks at him and just kind of looks like, who's this? The guy's like, who's this guy? And then it clicks for him, oh, that's my son, Franklin. He'd been gone so long that he didn't even recognize his own son. And to Billy Graham's credit, he said, at that point, I had realized I had to rearrange my life. And then he tells all these stories about how, like, his daughter would see a plane in the sky and say, bye, Daddy. And, like, he's like, I just had to rearrange my life because I wasn't passing it down to my own kids. Now, I don't know why he did. I don't know if that's what happens here. All I know is Belshazzar, the grandson, knows nothing of God and knows nothing of Daniel, who left an impression on Nebuchadnezzar, to say the least. Grandma comes in, queen comes in, she says, okay, but this guy, he can interpret your dreams. Call Daniel. Verse 13. So Daniel was brought before the king, and the king said to him, Are you Daniel, one of the exiles my father the king brought from Judah? I have heard that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that you have insight, intelligence, and outstanding wisdom. The wise men and the enchanters were brought before me to read this writing and tell me what it means, but they couldn't explain it. Now, I have heard that you are able to give interpretations and to solve difficult problems. If you read this writing and tell me what it means, you'll be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you'll be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. So, what should Daniel do? What should he do? If you were putting yourself in his shoes, do you interpret the dream or not? Do you do it? Do you help this guy as the Persians walk on in, as he's getting drunk with the holy relics from the temple of your people, of your God, who he destroyed, or his grandpa destroyed? He's not like, do you help him or do you not? I imagine the conversation in his head. He's been here before twice, right? Like chapter 2 and chapter 4, here's a vision. No one else can interpret it. Could you interpret it? He knows that at this point he can trust his God and he can interpret it. But he's been here before. The difference is that first vision was a full 60 years earlier. He was a kid. And now he's not a kid. He had given his life to helping Nebuchadnezzar, to changing the system, to fighting evil with love and compassion and grace. He had given his life. He finally sees some kind of hope. And then as soon as Nebuchadnezzar dies, over to the course of 23 years, he watches it slowly unravel. So what do you do? We have a word for this space. Because I have to imagine he's in a space where he's thinking, what's the point? We have a word for that. The word in our culture we would use for that is the word despair. Despair. Despair is the complete loss or absence of hope. Despair is a spiritual condition. It's the spiritual condition that says tomorrow will be exactly like today. So give up, or what's the point? Despair lives in the past, but it says that this thing that happened in the past will steal all of your future joy. That's despair. I was a college pastor for a season of my life, and I had the opportunity to see and confront a lot of despair in the course of those couple years. Despair is he hurt me, or she hurt me. I offered my heart. I was vulnerable. I did my best to care and to put myself out there. And then, like, one act of carelessness, one careless conversation, and, like, my heart it was like a beating heart. Please be good to me. And they broke it, and I refused to let anyone do that again. I refused to let anyone in like that again, and so I'll callous up, I'll build a wall around my heart, I'll refuse. That's despair. I will not allow the past pains I will allow the past pains to steal today's hope or joy. That's despair. I was talking to a pastor, a younger pastor, who was talking about when he started a job and how there was an older pastor retiring who had served the church for a while, and he said after the retirement party, he had asked this older pastor about the church that he was stepping into. And he said, what advice do you have? You've been pastoring this church for years. Like, what advice do you have for me as I step in this? And he said this older pastor had a cup of water, and he took his finger and he stuck it in the water, and he said, and he started shaking his finger around, and he said, I've been working here for a while, and I came in with all this energy, and we did all this stuff, programs, Bible studies, sermons, hours on sermons, conversations, fighting for marriage, all this stuff. And he said, I got old here. I got gray here. I got wrinkles here. And a couple months ago, I retired, and he pulls his finger out, and he said, and I watched as the church went right back to the way it was before I started. That's despair. That's despair. I have to imagine Daniel says, why give it a shot? I've already done this. I've been here. And you know what? Your grandpa was a bad dude, but he wasn't even close to as bad as you are. You're a snot-nosed. You're worse. Or maybe it's not despair or just despair. Maybe a bit of what he's feeling, the word we would use is cynicism. Cynicism is the I could help you. I could help you, but it's just going to get worse. You're just going to make it worse, right? Typically, cynicism disguises itself as humor. It's often clever or witty. If you meet somebody who's cynical, they're often clever or witty, or they'll come off as insightful, like, ooh, that's funny. Cynicism is essentially, so if despair lives in the past, if it's, hey, this thing happened back here and this is going to steal the joy from my future, cynicism exists in the future, and it essentially says that it's just going to get worse. So why now invest if it's just going to get worse? It's a giving up. It's a, no matter what we do, it's just going to get worse. Now you have to imagine, Daniel's watched this for 23 years unravel. It's just going to get worse. This guy's worse. We might as well just let the Persians take over. Cynicism actually banks on the, I'm going to throw the thing out there so that someday when the future happens, I can look back and say, I told you so. There's a post going around Facebook right now. I saw it. If one of you posted it, I'm sorry if you reshared it. But I think it's the best example I can think of cynicism right now. And essentially the post says, I'm just going to put this out here so that in 4 years, it pops back up in my newsfeed. Here's how great our economy is. Here's how great house prices are. Gas is like less than $2. Things are going really, really great right now, at least in the numbers I want to write down. And I'm just going to post it here so that in 4 years, I can be reminded. Essentially, it's showing the political hand of this person, but it's also saying, essentially, it's all going to get worse under the new president. Or it's I can't speak for the heart of the person, but it's I actually think I kind of want it to, so that in 4 years I can look back and say, I told you so. I warned you about this. Cynicism. So when you make the decision that you're going to refuse to be a cynic, you also lose the ability to say, I told you so. Because when you refuse to be a cynic, it forces you always to be in the game trying to make it go forward, right? When you refuse to be a cynic, you're always saying, okay, here's where we are. I may not have agreed with that. I may not have voted for this person, but I'm in it. Let's do our best. Let's try our hardest. And in 4 years, I'm gonna be right there with you. Like, yeah, this was hard. I imagine Daniel's thinking, okay, it's way easier right now to be a cynic and to point back, and someday I can point back and say, you know what, Nebuchadnezzar, good luck, man. Or Belshazzar, good luck. We'll see how this works out for you. And someday I can point back and say, I told you this was going to happen. You shouldn't have used the golden objects from the temple. This is the option that's before him, despair or cynicism. Daniel, verse 17. Then Daniel answered the king, you may keep your gifts for yourself. Remember, he gives like, hey, you have a golden chain and a purple robe. You may keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell him what it means. In other words, he says, I don't want your stuff, but I'll help. And then he goes on to interpret the vision. We won't read into it, but essentially the vision is, it's going to go down. It's not going to go down well. So like, sober up, dude. And like, let's start. You got to lead your people right now. It's not going to go well. You're going to be cut down. But lead your people. They need a king. But he leads with integrity. Why does he do it? It's what it means to be a follower of God. We just refuse to allow despair or cynicism to guide us. There's a contemporary of Daniel. He writes a few years before Daniel. It's a guy by the name of Jeremiah. He's a prophet. Jeremiah writes about the same event, the exile, and he says these words, Jeremiah 29:7. He says, also, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. He then goes on and warns them that, be careful, though. Don't sell your soul. Don't give up the things that matter to you. But do your best to make sure the city prospers so that you too will prosper. So where do we go from here? How do we seek the good of the city in our world, especially in a season of division, especially in 2020? If despair lives in the past and cynicism lives in the future, and the thing that both of them have in common is they're both rooted in fear. I'm afraid that this is going to keep returning, or I'm afraid that this is our future. So both of them, one of them is a defense mechanism so that we don't have to deal with that fear. The other is a defense mechanism so we don't have to deal with this fear. I want to suggest that for both of them, we do the really courageous work of actually addressing the fear. It takes zero courage to be a cynic. It takes zero courage to be a those of you who are musicians, it takes zero work to be a critic of music. I didn't like that song. That takes zero effort. Anyone can do that. Anyone, so whatever your gig is, right? It takes zero effort. Christine runs communication. It takes zero effort for somebody to be like, I didn't like that slide. Zero energy to do that. Zero energy to do that. Sorry for outing you right here. It takes zero energy to do that. The creative work is actually putting yourself out there, risking failure. So we got to address the fear. I want to offer two practices that I have found to be really helpful that that I want to invite you to try if you're wrestling with one of these two things or maybe both. The first is an effort to go back. It's a prayer practice. It's an ancient prayer practice known as imaginative prayer. Imaginative prayer. Now, when we hear the word imagination, we often think made up prayer. Not what I'm asking. So imaginative prayer is not, you're not making anything up. But essentially the practice goes like this. Something in the past hurt you. It's a breakup. I have a vivid memory on the school bus in fifth grade where somebody said something to me and I'm still carrying it. Right? So somebody does something. Parents often have a way of doing this. And they say something to you and it wedges its way in there. Now, if your parents knew that they said this, most of our parents probably would feel really bad. They didn't mean, but they were frustrated or they were stressed out, and so they said the thing, and then they forgot about it, but it wedged its way in there on you, and it's very real. You're carrying it still. Imaginative prayer says, go back to that moment. Maybe shut your eyes. What were you wearing? What were you feeling? Can you remember what it smelled like? How many of the details can you bring to the surface? And here's where the imaginative part comes in. This is why it's not made up. Imagine what's more true. What's more true? That for those of us who are Christians, that Jesus was present in that moment, though our eyes could not see him nor our ears hear him, but that he was present in spirit in that moment or that he wasn't. It's more true that he was present, right? Right? Right. So imaginative prayer recalls the moment, as painful as that is to do. Some of the moments that we repress are deeply painful. Actually, I was doing this practice. I was thinking about doing this with you, and then I remembered a moment where I had led a group, not this large of a group even, but I had led a group through this, and somebody just started weeping, and I realized this is really it can be a really powerful practice, and I would not want to expose that here with everybody else, but it can be, if you go vulnerable here, it can really, so you bring yourself back there, and I want you to then picture in that moment, okay, so if you're on the school bus, and the kid says the thing, and you find yourself like in that spot where it's like you're trying not to cry, where your face feels heavy, you know what I mean, like you're that moment, go back there, and I just want you to picture Jesus on that green seat next to you, and you turn to him, and he turns to you. What does he say? You're actually creating a space for God to talk to you, right? In doing that, you're creating a moment in your past where you can let God speak to you. And the closer you know him, the more you study the scriptures, the more you come to know Jesus, the more accurate what he says is going to feel. But you actually give God a space, an empty space. And maybe you're like, it's so deep that you can't actually pull that up yet. You can't hear anything from him. Okay. Like, I find I have such compassion on like 15-year-old Tim. Like, he was a knucklehead. Really, honestly. I said some things that were really mean. I did some things that were really dumb. College Tim, maybe even worse. I've got moments that I was ashamed of for years, and then I did this practice, and I found such compassion on younger me. Like, I was just trying to figure it out, just a middle schooler trying to like find his way through middle school without, right? Just a kid trying to figure out like how to deal with rejection, how to deal with somebody like finding out somebody said something about like I find like actually the shame has been replaced with some great compassion for this kid who was just trying to figure it out. But I needed Jesus to tell me that about me. I didn't need a self-help guru. I didn't need a pastor even. I needed Christ to say something that was true for me. So that's the first practice. The second practice, and this one's more about cynicism. This was a fun one. So the second practice, again, it's imaginative prayer, ancient practice. But what you're going to do is take some time, and this you can do this more in conversation. It can be just alone, just individually, but you can also do this with like a spouse or a parent or a friend or something. But essentially what you're going to do is you're going to imagine up your ideal future. So take the, in 4 years, here's what it's going to be. Okay, so take that cynicism comment, and instead of going cynicism on it, say, in 4 years, here's what I hope the world looks like. Okay? And you're, by the way, you're allowed to go as political as you want. You can dream up the perfect Republican utopia or the Democrat utopia. I don't care. I don't care. But you're going to dream up your perfect world. Now, here's the questions. In your perfect world, what brings you joy? In your perfect world, what relationships are you pouring into? What kinds of things are you talking about with those people? Where are you spending your energy? How does somebody else who steps into your perfect world know that you're filled with joy? What's your body composure like? What's your face doing? How do I know that you're feeling joy? Picture it. Now, here's the question. Can you start living as though that's true now? And you'll initially think, well, the world's not like that. How can I have that joy if the world's not like that? But if enough of us decided we're going to choose to live that way now, even though our world may be divided and fighting right now, we're going to choose to treat everyone as though we love them and they're welcome at our table. Or we're going to not fight our uncle about that issue because we know where that's going to go. Instead, we're going to treat our uncle, whatever. If more of us started acting like that now, we may actually find ourselves building that world. Two practices. Liza and I hung up our Christmas lights last weekend. And I think a part of it, as I was like, part of it was because it was nice weather, and that's what we were going to do because I didn't want to do it in the rain or the snow. True. But a part of it was I think that we are just refusing to resign this season and give up hope. We're just absolutely at war against cynicism and despair. We are absolutely at war, and we were doing our best to try to recognize it in ourselves and to call it out of ourselves as soon as it starts to hit. I do not want that putting down roots in my heart. And I don't think you do either. Chapter 4 felt like an ending to the book of Daniel, and then chapter 5 comes, but the good news is chapter 5 also isn't the ending. We'll pick up next week. Would you join me in a word of prayer? Gracious Lord, I pray for our church, and I pray for my friends, especially this week of COVID surging in our area, and many of us have loved ones who are sick. Lord, we pray for their health. But Lord, we also, in this season, as we think about how do we do Thanksgiving and what's going to happen with schools and restaurants, and Lord, I pray that you may help us to stay in the fight, but also help us to do that in a way that doesn't resort to despair or cynicism. Jesus, we need to be good news people. We want to be good news people. We want to be gospel people. In a world that so desperately aches for some good news, King Jesus, would we, Lord, we don't even need to imagine it being true for us, Lord. We know that we have access to joy and hope and love, perfect love that drives out fear. And so, Lord, would you help us to live as though that is true right now? And Jesus, help us to choose you new every single day. Lord, we love you, and we pray this in your name, and everybody said.
Once again, we want to say thanks for listening. For more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, visit us on the web at www.southharbor.org, or find us on Facebook and Instagram at South Harbor Church. And so, from all of us here at South Harbor Church and the Harbor Churches, once again, we want to wish you a blessed week.